The movie Serpico came out on TV after it was in theaters. And when it was over, I was like, all jumping up and down. I can't wait to be a NYPD cop. I can't wait to be a cop.
What did you think of how our military took down Maduro?
Our military's the greatest there's ever been, and that was a perfect example of why.
We just had Officer Memorial Week. Nothing on that on the news.
I think good cops will always want to stop bad cops, because if they're criminals, that's what we do. We go after criminals.
When you first went into the FBI, well, what was your first assignment?
So my first week in the FBI, Monday, I'm interviewing and interrogating the former president of a foreign country to flip them for a narcotics investigation. By Friday, I'm working on an international espionage case. September 11, 2001, Pentagon was struck. All the communications for every agency shared communication with the FBI just minutes before the building collapsed. Hundreds of people would have died. No one was even injured.
There's a certain kind of person that is willing to sacrifice himself in that way.
You know, all of this, what's the future of the country? We can only hope that Proud American Studios, podcasts like this grow and grow, and more people are exposed to reality and the truth.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Hero Next Door at Proud American Studios. I'm your co-host, international film and television star Nick Searcy, and along with me is my much more qualified friend, Dr. Darcy Lutzinger. Say hello, Darcy.
Hey, everybody. I'm on from Romeo, Michigan in the cornfields. Happy to be with everybody tonight.
Yeah, I'm coming to you live tonight from McQuaidie, Kentucky, where I live, where I got away from California and moved. But we're lucky today because this show is dedicated to the unspoken heroes of law enforcement and our military that risk their lives for the service of our country. And today we're lucky enough to have a friend of mine. He's got a long, long, boring resume of just incredible things. But he started out as a police officer, became an FBI agent, then became a counterterrorism expert, worked with NBA teams and other large venues to try to prevent terrorist attacks, and then successfully made the transition into my profession, into the movie business. And his name is Tim Clemente. Nice to have you with us, Tim.
Thanks for having me, Nick. Great to be here with you and Darcy. Look forward to having a nice chat with you.
Yeah, I think... Well, you know, I'd like to just sort of go through your career a little bit and, talk about how you got started. What made you want to be a police officer?
That's a question I can't answer, because it's something, and it's the only thing I ever wanted to do. Ever since I can remember being, I always wanted to be a cop. I don't know if it was episodes of Adam 12 when I was a little kid or what it was, because there were no police officers in my family. But I can remember in first grade, and my sister actually has the physical evidence for this, I had to write my autobiography in first grade. And of course, I talked about what I wanted to be when I grew up, which was, I want to be a police officer. And the autobiography was probably three sentences. My name, I'm 5 years old. I want to be a police officer when I grew up. And
that's great.
So that my sister still has that report, because when my mother passed away, my sister took a lot of her effects and saved them. And she showed it to me about 15 years ago. And I don't remember writing it, but I can remember feeling that. So, you know, I think most people, law enforcement and military, that make careers of it, it's a vocation. It's not a job. So it's something I felt a calling to do. I always wanted to do, and I love doing so.
Hey, Tim, did you have family members that were law enforcement, or did you have any like incredible positive interactions? Because usually I get the Adam 12, because that's what I used to watch also. Mm-hmm. And I go, those weren't the coolest cops in the world, now that I look back on it, but there was like the only cop show. Was there something that just like really made it for you?
I don't know. There's nothing that sticks in my memory about when I was a child, like interactions with cops helping me across the street or anything. I don't know what it was. I just always had a very positive impression of law enforcement, and I absolutely still do. And it's all I ever wanted to do. I mean, like some kids grow up, hey, I want to be a doctor. I want to be an actor. I don't know if you knew anybody like that, Nick, but and it's just like that's your vocation. It's all you want to do in life. And that's all I ever wanted to do. I can't explain why. And I know, I remember my parents, the movie Serpico, where it came out on TV after it was in theaters. And I was probably 12 years old when I watched it. So I watched it like on the, you know, the 4:30 movie or something in the afternoon on TV. And I watched it with my parents. And when it was over, I was like, oh, jumping up and down. I can't wait to be a NYPD cop. I can't wait to be a cop. And my mother was like, why don't you consider going into the FBI so you don't end up getting shot in the face like Serpico did? And not to spoil, you know, spoil the movie for anybody that hasn't seen it, but you know, it's an amazing story of a heroic cop that goes against injustice within his own department. But you know, I was always encouraged by those things.
Well, the crazy thing is, I saw that movie too. I saw it at 12. I loved Serpico, but I watched it and I didn't think I want to be a cop. I watched it. I want to be that guy pretending to be a cop. That's what I want to do.
And they can all be girls anyway, Nick.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's actually some rewarding aspects to doing what you do, playing a cop, which are more so than the reality of law enforcement, especially today where they're disparaged so terribly. And, you know, I can't call it anything but lies about killer police officers, that they kill so many unarmed people every year. And you look at the actual numbers and it's infinitesimally small. And I always bring up when I hear that stupid debate about, you know, well, cops are killers, they're killing innocent people and they should be stopped. And it's like, yeah, a bad cop should always be stopped. A bad person in any profession, it doesn't matter who they are, should always be stopped. And I think good cops will always want to stop bad cops, because if they're criminals, that's what we do. We go after criminals. And
well, I think, Tim, the media portrays that though, right?
Yeah.
Because they don't show all the great stuff that law enforcement does every day. We just had Officer Memorial Week, right, in Washington, D.C. Yeah. So we're honoring all the officers that lost their life in the line of duty. Nothing on that on the news. But they want to focus everything on negative, don't they? And that's what I think the bad part is.
You know, and if you look at numbers, let's look at raw data. Johns Hopkins University several years ago did a study on how many people die because of medical mistakes, malpractice and medical mistakes. And the number was between 250 and 400,000 people a year die because of medical mistakes and medical malpractice. And so if you look at the number of interactions doctors have with patients and cops have with the public, the number of people that die wrongly at the hand of a cop is like anywhere from 15 to 27 a year, I think. So compare that to 250 to 400,000, and yet the cops are the bad guys. I'm not saying we should disparage and attack doctors. Most doctors and nurses and medical professionals, I think, are out there trying to save lives and make people's lives healthier and more livable. But still, they end up killing a whole heck of a lot of people. And cops do not. Cops do not do that. And yet they're treated like they're demonic. It's horrible.
Yeah.
Go back to your original question, which I don't think I've answered yet. I wanted to be a cop since I can remember being. And so I actually, the day I went to college in New York City, and the day after I graduated college, I went down to apply two places, NYPD. NYPD was like, basically, we're in a hiring freeze. We're not going to be hiring for a while. So you're not going to get in unless you know somebody or you got some steam. And then I went down to 26 Federal Plaza in Manhattan and tried to apply to the FBI. And the FBI gave me a different answer, but it was still no. And that answer was, you're too young. You have to be at least 23 years old. I was 21. And you have to have at least 3 years of work experience after college. And you graduated yesterday. So and that was virtually true. So my law enforcement career was on hold right off the bat. And I ended up moving to the Midwest and living outside St. Louis. And St. Louis PD was hiring. So I jumped at that opportunity. It was an extremely violent city, a very, very high crime rate. And that was exactly what I was looking for. So I started out there and loved it. Loved being
on
the street.
Did you work, Tim? Because a department like St. Louis PD's got a lot of opportunities, right? You know, they've got, like you said, undercover work. They've got detective, mounted. Did you do patrol there? Is that specifically the job that you had, is patrol division?
Yeah, I was with patrol division. I graduated number one from the academy. And so on the day before graduation, the sergeant that ran the academy called me and the guy that came in number two into his office and said, okay, Tim, you're number one. The other guy, you're number two. And he said, you get to choose where you want to work. Where do you want to work? What district, what division do you want to work in, department? I said, well, is the third district still the the toughest, meanest, bloodiest division in the city? And he said, yes, it is. It's still called the Bloody Third for a reason. And I said, well, that's where I want to go. And so the number two guy couldn't go there because it was my choice. So he had to go to the second most bloodiest division, the fifth district in Northern St. Louis. So I got to choose, went to a very, very busy district, very high crime rate because of gang violence, drugs, homicides. You know, it was busy. It was busy every day. And I loved it. I mean, there was never a time where we were bored, not a day.
Is there one particular incident when you were in that district that you remember, one particular bust or one particular event?
I think I can recall one particular Saturday where I had five homicides in my individual beat. So a beat might have been like an 8-square block area. I had 11 homicides that week, five homicides that Saturday. And a few of them were particularly gruesome and, you know, just totally innocent people that were victimized. One guy was walking into a grocery store, stepped on the pad that opens the door. The door swung open. He took a step and a shot rang out and he fell face down inside the door. And we got the call. I got there a few minutes later and the door kept trying to automatically close and kept hitting him in the head laying there. And people were just in shock. Nobody saw the shooter. And it was such a random act of violence. It was rare because most of the violence there is drug and gang related. So it's gang members shooting each other. Occasionally you had robberies that were, you know, random victims. But this was a really rare one where a guy just capped in the back of the head for no reason. They didn't rob him. They didn't do anything to him. And, you know, and then I'm on that scene. The guy clearly is dead. He's declared on the scene. And so we hand it over to homicide division. Homicide comes and takes over that crime scene. My next call, another possible homicide victim. I get over there. A woman in her antique store is shot. Similar, different caliber gun, different description of suspect and everything else. So it wasn't the same person, but two killings within an hour. And then I had a triple homicide about 2 hours after that one. So I remember that was, you know, there's a lot of cops that work their whole career and never work a homicide. I never worked a week where I didn't work a homicide in my beat. And this was my busiest with 11 in a week and 5 in one day.
Wow.
Tim, how did you process that? Because we talk about the effects that things have on law enforcement. And most civilians see two or three significant incidents in their life. And that's a lot. You caught that in a week.
Yeah.
I assume you had a pretty normal upbringing where you didn't see homicides on a regular basis. Not too many dead bodies, didn't respond to a lot of high stressful things growing up. So you're into the fire. How are you processing this whole thing? Brand new kid out of the academy, fresh and green. I'm assuming you're in the FTO program or some type of training program with some good people.
Yeah. Yeah, we did have an FTO program, and it was pretty short for in my circumstance, I think, because we were kind of shorthanded at the time. But so, yeah, I jumped right into it. I mean, I think I had a homicide my first day on the street. And I remember my first day, we also had our first fight. And so it was the reality, like on Adam 12, you didn't see a lot of homicides. You never saw blood and gore. And it never really bothered me. Like I didn't have any traumatic, mental problems from it, no post-traumatic stress or anything like that. And I think it was because of the pursuit for justice for those people that yeah, it's an innocent person laying there, but I got to find the bad guy. So there was never, I never felt like I was traumatized by it. Always felt like that person that's laying there dead and bleeding needs me to find justice for them. And that's kind of what my goal was in being in law enforcement anyway. So it kind of reinforced why I was there and what I was trying to do rather than me looking on it and seeing how horrible this is. I saw this is my mission. This is just God presenting me with something that I need to react to, respond to, investigate, and find justice for this victim that's laying there. So that always motivated me, right? Whether that was when I was a cop with an individual, or like I said, a triple homicide, or when I was working for the FBI where we had 300 or 400 dead bodies around us on a crime scene.
Yeah. It reminds me of that one time I went to the set and I went to the craft service table and the coffee was really cold. It was a very traumatic event.
Well,
you live the struggle, over it, Nick.
You look at the bigger mission. Always find
the
bigger
struggle,
mission.
Nick.
That's right. Yeah. I'm here to provide entertainment.
Heroes,
yeah.
Nick, not all heroes wear capes, okay?
So. That's right. That's right. Well, after your experiences in St. Louis, what motivated you to go to the FBI? Was that something that was all you always had planned, that you were going to go there as soon as you were old enough?
Yeah, it was. I thought about it. I always wanted to be a cop first. I actually went to the FBI after the police, the day after I graduated college, to honor my mother, telling me I should do that. My mother actually passed away the next year. And so it was to honor her, because she said you should consider becoming an FBI agent. So I just did it really to humor and honor her. And then so when I was a cop, I worked for a few years. And then my brother had become an FBI agent. So right around the time I became a cop, he joined the FBI, and I was ticked off at him. What the heck are you doing taking my profession? You know, he had gone to law school, and he was working as a prosecutor, and then he ended up working on a case with the FBI, and one of them slid an application across the table to him at lunch one day, and he applied, got in. And so here I was with the police department, and I was loving every minute of it. But the thing I didn't love was the pay. I didn't do it for the money. You know, most people don't become cops for the money, because, there's some better paying jobs in law enforcement today. But back then, we were the lowest paid major metropolitan police department in the country. And my wife, while I was a cop, by then she had had our fifth child. So here I am raising five kids. My wife's staying at home, taking care of the kids and homeschooling them. And I was making $24,000 a year. And so my brother calls me and says, hey, FBI's going into a hiring spree again. They're going to hire 1,000 agents over the next 2 years. You should apply. And I was like, I don't know. And he said, you know, the starting pay is only $49,000 in the academy, but you'll make more than that when you get out. And I was like, only $49,000? Are you kidding me? So I went home and told my wife, hey, Karen, the FBI's hiring, and the starting pay in the academy is $49,000. She said, when do you start?
Yeah.
And so that was a big push in that direction, was that, you know, with a growing family and having a little bit better income. And also, I don't know how many shootouts I had been in by this time, at least half a dozen different shootouts, where luckily I didn't have any new bodily orifices. They were horrible shooters every time. But so my wife was at the point where it's like, you know, at some point in time, that luck's going to run out on the street, because there's no shortage of violence here. So maybe you should look more closely at getting paid better and dressing a little better and being a little safer. So
yeah, but Tim, the amount of experience you got in that 2 or 3 years, you can't get that in so many years. I was in law enforcement for 27 years, and I worked a lot of task force with federal agents, bank robberies, things like that. And you know what? They're not answering domestic calls. They're not going to shooting in progress. You're not going into high stressful situations. As you're driving there, you're trying to formulate what's happening. And I think it had to make you a better FBI agent, right?
Oh, I definitely think so. I think the greatest thing, though, Darcy, that really helped me from my law enforcement, starting as a police officer, to the FBI, was dealing with the dregs of society. So when you're an FBI agent, you know, it's an elite institution. They think of themselves as elite. And here I am coming from St. Louis Metro PD, where, I'm in a shootout with a bunch of gangbangers. And an hour later, I'm in the station interrogating these gangbangers and finding out who's responsible. Why? What are they doing? Why did they shoot at me? Well, they were going to kill somebody else. I got in the way, you know, that kind of thing. And I got to be able to relate to these guys. I got to sit across the table and bring myself to their level, not be elite and hoity-toity, because I'm never going to get them to talk. And then I want to flip these guys, because the leader of their gang is who we're after, because he's the one that ordered the hit and said, and if any cops get in your way, kill them. So we want that guy in prison too. And so, you know, learning to deal with anyone in any strata of society, any aspect of whatever culture you're facing. And you know, even in a city like St. Louis, there's an international flavor. You got people from all over, and being able to communicate with them and establish a rapport was my greatest asset in the FBI. And so you get to the FBI and they tell you day one in the academy, we are part of the intelligence community. Your mission as an FBI agent is to gather intelligence, solve crimes, yes, prevent terrorist acts and other acts, yes, but you do that through intelligence gathering. So you can't sit at a desk and wait for the phone to ring and be able to prevent acts of terrorism. You have to talk to people that are close to terrorists or are terrorists. And so I think that the greatest tool I got, the greatest superpower, was learning how to talk to anybody and empathize with, understand, and develop a rapport. And so when I got to the FBI, it made the job so easy. And I think there were myself and a bunch of other former cops that all excelled right off the bat. We hit the ground running because we didn't have any ramp up to try and figure out how to do the job. It was just like an extension of what we had done before and a magnification of it. Greater assets, greater tools, greater capabilities, greater budgets. Everything was greater in the FBI than it was in the police.
Did you find yourself focusing on one particular thing when you first went into the FBI? Was it what was your first assignment?
Well, when you get in the academy, they do a skills evaluation. They give you this like fill in the blank form. It's actually a checkbox form with thousands and thousands and thousands of different skills. And you have to go through this form. Like, you might be great at cross stitch, sewing, painting, anything, artwork, dance, anything at all that a human can possibly do is on this skills assessment sheet. And you have to rate yourself on every one of these things. Like, you know, samba dancing, 0.
Wow.
Is my skill. firearms, high speed driving, carpentry work. I had been in construction years before, so I was really good at carpentry. I had a lot of tools. So I rate myself on each of the different skills, cabinet making, finished carpentry. And so that they take that and they evaluate that and they look at your background and then they see where they need you. And so I got assigned to an international narcotics squad right out of the academy in Washington, D.C. But my first week on the job, because of that skills assessment sheet, even though I was assigned to a narcotics squad, actually my first day, I was assigned to pick up 2 L.A. division FBI agents that were flying in and take them to an interview. And we were interviewing a former head of state of another country who was being implicated in a drug cartel operation. And wow. We had to interview him. So here I am, literally my first day working for the FBI. At midnight, I'm in a hotel with a former president of another country. And I can't talk about who it is, but it involved the cartels. And we were flipping this guy. We had to flip him. So we had to turn him, flip him, get him to cooperate against the cartel. And I was like, this is day one. I can't imagine what this is going to be like for the rest of my life. But later that week, that was on a Monday. On Friday, I get a call at my desk. And they said, is this Tim Clemente? I said, yes. They said, be outside Washington field office at 5:07. A van will pick you up. And I was like, what am I doing? And they said, don't worry, a van will pick you up. So I'm waiting outside the FBI building. Van pulls up. They put me in. It's all blacked out. No windows. I can't see anything. They drive me for a little while, put a hood over my head and a blindfold on.
Wow.
And it was an espionage case that the FBI had been working for years. And the target of that espionage case was about to buy a house on Monday morning. The FBI on Friday evening bought that house and owned it from Friday evening till the closing at Monday morning. And so in that interceding little over 48 hours, they needed to hide microphones and cameras and all kinds of keystroke readers, all kinds of really cool spy stuff in this house. And they needed finished carpenters to be able to perfectly match moldings and cabinet doors, because they were hiding these things everywhere. So they were like, here's your skills assessment sheet from the academy. You ranked yourself 90 out of 100 on cabinet building. And I said, well, yeah, I ran a cabinet shop for 3 years and did cabinet installations for Sears and other stores. I did all of their kitchens. And they were like, good, here's what you're going to do. And I walk in and they are tearing everything out of this house. All the kitchen cabinets, they had taken pictures and they said, you have to put this all back together when we're done. And so it was wild. So my first week as an FBI agent, I was like, this is unbelievable.
Yeah.
I interviewed a president on Monday and now I'm doing this. And I'm a narcotics investigator. So I worked international narcotics and we got to target the Cali cartel. And that was phenomenal. You know, I I grew my hair, had a ponytail down my back, and I'm flying to Caracas, Venezuela on an undercover mission with a guy I just took out of prison because we were targeting a Cali leader who was going to meet us at Carnival in Venezuela at Caracas. And then, you know, a couple months later, I'm in Medellin, Colombia, flying around in a covert DEA aircraft. So, I mean, the experiences were incredible. It was a lot different than walking around the same beat and chasing gangbangers who are shooting people and working homicides. So I did that for the first 4.5 years out of Washington, D.C. Great work.
What did you think of how our military took down Maduro?
Oh, took him phenomenal. Just yeah. An incredible operation. And you know, why did we take him down? All the politics behind that. It's fascinating. You know, here's a guy that's an illegitimate leader of a country, right? He had falsified election results and cheated to stay in office. But he's also a cartel member. He's giving the cartel so much power and influence and allowing them to destroy our culture and kill people. And it's amazing to me. I transitioned in 1999 from international narcotics to international terrorism. And I always thought of the two as the same. I didn't think there should be a delineation. Back when I was working international narcotics and we're targeting the Cali cartel, the Cali cartel is no different than Al-Qaeda. Every institution in the world has to have some form of financing if they're going to exist, whether that's, you know, the Catholic Church raising, you know, money by passing the plate at mass every Sunday and I put my check in there, or it's the Taliban in Afghanistan growing poppy and feeding heroin to the world in order to fund their insurgency. And Al-Qaeda is doing similar things and the cartels do those things. So it was always amazing to me that we looked at the cartels just as a criminal entity, just as criminal organizations, because they operate the same as a terrorist organization and they act the same and they have the same net effect. And so with the Maduro thing, designating the cartels as terrorist organizations, brilliant, should have been done decades ago.
Yeah.
And then one by one, plopping incendiary and explosive devices onto small boats that are moving drugs in the ocean. Brilliant tactic, because, you know, those guys get paid a little bit to go around the ocean and bring the hard narcotics to the United States. And it's the recruiting tool is, hey, you know, you're going to do this or we're going to kill you, or we're going to do that. You're going to do this and we're going to pay you. And so some people do it for money. Some people do it because they're forced to. But the recruiting efforts are greatly diminished when they're getting blown up randomly in the ocean. And so doing that and then moving our naval assets closer and closer and closer to Venezuela as they're interdicting these boats looks like it's just part of that interdiction effort. And then, whoop, sweep in, pull the fake leader of the country out. And now you've got one of the top cartel guys in the world in custody. I just thought it was a phenomenal operation. Military, our military's the greatest there's ever been, and that was a perfect example of why.
Well, they call it, I mean, the name of the show is Hero Next Door, right? And you know, Tim, about planning and execution, all right? And the planning is one part of that, and the planning had to be extraordinary for all the pieces to fall into place the way they did. But then you put it on top of that and you put brave men and women that executed the plan, and a million things can go wrong. And I'm sure some things did go wrong during
it. Yeah, they did.
We don't know about, but you know what? They've got, you know, they got backup plans in place. You got brave men and women that train every day to do this. And then they're falling over each other to actually do the job. It's just, you're watching that thing, Tim, and probably like me going, God, how could I not have been on that? Why couldn't they have called me to do that? Because it was just the ultimate team job, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Perfectly executed. Yeah. And you said things go wrong. Yeah. They had to blow up and destroy two aircraft, right? You know, that's the cost of doing business. You got a problem. You got communications equipment you can't let fall into enemy hands. You got technology we can't let fall into enemy hands. So you destroy it. And so it's like, boom, move past. Where's our next extraction point? Where's our next aircraft coming in from? And they always have backup plans. So it was, yeah, the execution was just phenomenal. When the movie comes out, you know, hopefully it has a, you know, tremendous international film and television stars such as Nick Searcy.
I heard Nick is in the lead for this thing. I'm not positive.
Yeah.
He ought to be. Yeah.
The AI stuff they can do now, I can play like in my 20s now. So it's it's going to, you know.
Well, keep working on that tan, and maybe you can play Maduro.
That's what kind of hairdo they're going to put on you, Nick, for that. Yeah. What they're going to do with that.
Yeah, they it's if I'm Maduro, you know, we know it's going to be that slick back thing, you know,
with a jogging suit.
Yeah, but yeah, but that strike was so surgical and so shocking. I mean, it just, you know, looking in as just a guy not with military experience, I just went, that's the most fantastic, most incredible thing I think I've ever seen. You know,
yeah, it was, you know, our elite special operations units are just, there's no comparison. I mean, some European forces are pretty equal, but they're much smaller. So like I've trained with special operations units in multiple countries around the Middle East, all over Europe. So like the French GIGN, which is their gendarmerie, not the closest thing to our Delta Force, their Commando Hubert, which is their version of SEAL Team 6. I was with the British SBS, a couple of their people, and we'll be training with them over the summer. And so, you know, there are elite units all over the world, but none that measure like, you know, the size of our Delta Force or our SEAL Team 6 versus other countries. It's incomparable. We have hundreds and hundreds of guys with budgets that are, you know, the decimal point is seven places to the right of where it would be for a European unit. So we have the training and the equipment that they can't do. They can't spend those dollars and do that kind of training and have that kind of expendable equipment where we can. So they can't, you know, if the French Commando Hubert, their version of SEAL Team 6, had to go and do an operation like that, they couldn't lose two aircraft. So they couldn't spare a dozen or 15 extra aircraft with other, you know, quick reaction forces ready to come in. They just don't have the manpower and the money to do those things. It's why when you hear about those stories, it's us. It's always us.
Do you think that there was another reason outside of him being an illegitimate leader and a head of, you know, a part of the drug cartel? Was there the presence of maybe other terrorist organizations in Venezuela? And that could that have been part of the reason we had to take him out?
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of reasons. There's a whole, I'm sure the president's looking at a stack of briefings on a whole host of different reasons why we're there and why we needed to go in. A couple of those reasons would be groups like Hezbollah being in the region, and Hezbollah and Hamas and even Al-Qaeda have been in South and Central America for decades. They've been using the tripart region, further south, Argentina, Brazil, other countries in that area, and up into Venezuela when Maduro and other communist leaders started taking over, and then other communist countries came in. So you had Russia there, you had China. And why are they there? Well, they're there for a host of reasons. One, because they can interact with those groups, terrorist groups and cartel groups in South America to destabilize the Western hemisphere and destabilize the United States. In addition, they needed those resources. As much oil as Russia has, they need more. They can't expand and they can't have influence in other regions without the ability to have energy from those regions. So you're not going to pump oil out of Russia, send it down there and try and establish a base of operations in South or Central America. You need energy sources there. You need the ability to get that without having to drag it halfway across the world. And China, of course, needs energy for in China. They have the Silk Road, where they're influencing economies all over the world. I worked in East Africa, and China was heavily trying to influence there. And so in South America, especially in a place where you have somebody like Maduro, who is a communist, considers himself a communist, is a terrorist, considers himself a narco leader, but is actually a terrorist. So he's cooperating with and working with our adversaries from China and Russia. And I'm not saying those countries are necessarily our enemies, but, you know, nations don't have friends, they have interests. And at this point in time, our interests are to protect the Western Hemisphere and America from the interests of Russia and China. And destabilizing an illegitimate regime in Caracas was the best way to do that. And I'm sure our operations that we're looking at in Cuba and other places are because of these same influences. We know Russia, for, you know, since the Bay of Pigs, has heavily influenced things going on in Cuba. And so I think that's why there's been a lot of dialogue lately about, oh, are we going to go into Cuba next? I don't know if we will, but I'm sure if we do, it's not because we want their cigars.
Right. By doing these things, we are literally defunding our terrorist enemies, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. because I, you know, as I mentioned before, every form of insurgency, guerrilla warfare, any kind of tactics that are being done have to be funded in some way. And so you have to have some kind of contraband generally, or some form of commerce. And so if that's taking Venezuelan oil and expropriating the resources, the money that comes from it, and using it to fund other military operations, destabilizing operations in the region, they're of course going to do that. And we have to take that option away from them.
Well, after the cartels, I think you spent a little bit of time in the Middle East, didn't you? Did you do some work over there? Was that sort of a transition from narcotics to terrorism, or was it all kind of the same piece?
No, it was a transition for sure, Nick. It was something that was mandated by the U.S. Attorney General at the time, John Ashcroft, in 1998. Osama bin Laden had issued a fatwa against Americans anywhere in the world at any time, and basically he was calling us a paper tiger because of what happened in Mogadishu in 1994 and the fact that we had been attacked so many times by Iran and other proxies around the world and that we never truly struck back. So Osama bin Laden described America as a paper tiger and called for what, you know, loosely is affiliated as Al-Qaeda around the world to attack Americans at any time in any place. And so when that fatwa came out, the U.S. Attorney General, John Ashcroft, said to the FBI, you have to develop a capability, a global capability to react to and deal with and possibly prevent terrorist acts anywhere they might occur. And so that began in 1999 as the National Capital Response Squad in Washington, D.C. And what that was within the FBI, everybody's working cases. And then you have specialty assignments, which are ancillary to, in addition to your regular casework. So while I'm working drug cases, I'm also part of what's called the rapid deployment team, which is a team of people that when a bombing or something would happen overseas, like for instance, in 1998, August 7th, the U.S. embassies were blown up in East Africa, in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and in Nairobi, Kenya. And so I was part of the team that afternoon, called into the office, bombing today in East Africa. You're going to go to one of those places. And that by midnight that night, I was loading up, going to get on a plane. And I went to both those countries, spent about a month in both those countries. And so in 1999, this capability was taken where all of the assets that are special skills. So bomb techs, SWAT team, rapid deployment team, which is just investigators that can go anywhere at any time. The hazardous materials response teams, the evidence response teams, and the FBI dive team. And the FBI dive team really expanded. A good buddy of mine named Bobby Chacon, who you should definitely interview for this, was the one that actually grew that program. And it came out of the USS Cole bombing in Yemen, Aden, Yemen, on October 12, 2000. My squad was the first squad in the air. We went over there to deal with that crime scene, to process it, and to also process the bodies of the fallen. There were 17 sailors that were killed on that on the USS Cole. And my squad mates with that particular skill set had to identify the remains and remove the remains of all those sailors on that, while other members of the squad. So I was in a boat on the water while we were processing the bomb scene, the hole in the side of the ship, for any physical evidence and clues for the investigation. So that squad, the National Capital Response Squad, became the basis, and then it later expanded to other offices within the FBI. And so my office in Washington, D.C., because of our geographic location, we were responsible for Europe, the Balkans, the Middle East, and Africa. So we had all those hotspots. The New York division had all the former Soviet republics. The Miami division had South and Central America. And Los Angeles had the South Pacific and Asia. And so we were broken up geographically, and we would all have warehouses. So we had a warehouse in Washington, D.C., and another one at Ramstein Air Force Base in Germany, where we forward deployed clothing, equipment, tools, food, water, anything we would need to be able to deploy on a minute's notice to anywhere in the world. So we were on a 2-hour or 4-hour leash at all times. We could never be without special permission. We couldn't be more than 4 hours away from Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland because that was our callback time. You had to be able to be with your equipment on a plane within 4 hours of receiving a message.
Everything you're talking about there, that happened before 9/11, correct?
Yeah, those were so the U.S. embassies were 1998.
Yeah.
We worked an assassination in Sarajevo, Bosnia, the same year in 1998. In 2000, we had the USS Cole. And then, of course, in September 11th happens, September 11th, 2001. And the Pentagon, being in the Washington, D.C. area, was our crime scene. So our squad worked that crime scene. It was our scene for 65 days. We were there day and night.
How long were you on the ground right after that happened?
9/11. I didn't go home. I used to live about 40, 45 miles from the Pentagon, and I didn't go home for 6 weeks. I didn't make it further than the Pentagon.
After the attack, Tim, how long, were you there same day?
Oh yeah. Yeah. So, on the morning of September 11th, I was a SWAT team leader, for the Washington field office at that time. And so we were actually in the Virginia Beach area with SEAL Team 6. So we were training. We were doing a counterterrorism training with SEAL Team 6. We were in their shoot house on the morning of September 11th when I got notified there's been an attack in New York. A plane struck the World Trade Center. So we started packing up our gear after the first plane hit, and then the second plane hit, and then the Pentagon got hit. So we were going to head up to New York, and we ended up going back to Washington, D.C., our division. So we got there just about an hour and a half after the plane hit. And we already had squad members on scene within 7 minutes. We had FBI agents on scene taking over control of the scene. And the reason that we do that is because, you know, command and control operations are very difficult in a big situation like that. Everybody knows that communication is the first thing that breaks down. We look at what happened on 9/11 in New York City. You have the World Trade Center. You have all these entities. You have the FBI. You have ATF. You have NYPD. You have FDNY. And they all set up their own command posts in New York. And they all had their own communications. And that led to, unfortunately, a lot of deaths, because the police were getting one source of intelligence and information on the structure being destabilized by the fires burning. The fire department's running in while the police are running out. And then the building collapses and 300 plus members of FDNY and Port Authority are killed and along with thousands of other people. But it's not the fault of the communications, but the communications, unfortunately, might have been able to prevent some of that. Obviously, it's a terrorist act. Whereas at the Pentagon, it was a different situation. Because of our squad was known as the liaison squad for the FBI. So we had to have liaison with every entity that we might work with in any circumstance. And so every agency that responded to the Pentagon was directly related to our squad. So the head of every one of those agencies was our liaison assignment. So Chris Combs, one of the agents from my squad, responded to the Pentagon first. He was there within minutes. He set up incident command, and he told every other agency, Arlington Fire Department, Pentagon Police, Pentagon Fire Department, Pentagon City Fire Department, Pentagon City Police, Virginia State Police, ATF, Secret Service, everybody that was responding, he said, this is incident command. All communications will be through me right here. Nobody communicates on a radio that I don't control, because we will all talk together. And so what a lot of people don't know is there was a collapse at the Pentagon a couple hours after the plane hit. And we had engineers on the ground. Those engineers said these columns are destabilized from the wing inertia. The building itself, the fuselage, went all the way through multiple rings, but the wings took out multiple columns and destabilized others. The wings got decimated and destroyed before the fuselage did. So the fuselage did the most damage because it has the greatest mass. So we had these engineers in there. They did a quick inspection, and they said to the FBI, evacuate, evacuate, evacuate. FBI commander picks up the radio. Every other agency there is on the FBI radio net at that point. They all have an FBI radio, and we have their radios. They are all told, evacuate, evacuate, evacuate. There's going to be a collapse. A couple of hundred people come rushing out of the building, and about 10 seconds later, the facade of the building collapses. Nobody was injured, and it was all because that incident command was set up, and it became the model now around the world for these incidents since then. But sadly, in New York, they didn't. They you know, you have a huge department. FDNY has tens of thousands of people, and they're incredibly brave. And you know, there's the possibility that even if they've been told the building's going to collapse, I'm sure most of those firefighters still would have run in to try and rescue people. And yep. So that's a question of, you know, what if, but, you know, the bravery of all those cops and firefighters. And, you know, we talked earlier about how law enforcement is disparaged so much today. Think about what the reaction was on 9/11 to all that bravery and heroism. How many people, there's your heroes next door. There's your true American heroes that,
for sure,
regardless of the absolute danger of the situation, those guys are running in and running up 100 flights of stairs to try and save people. Just incredible.
It takes a special breed of human being to do what they do and what you do, Tim. And that's kind of why I asked you at the beginning why you wanted to do this. It's like there is a certain kind of person that is willing to sacrifice himself in that way. And I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. You know, I appreciate what our military heroes do, our firefighters, law enforcement. They're all heroic. And, you know, yeah, there's some bad apples in all, but there's bad apples in every human entity. But the great thing is about the people that truly are heroes that step in the breach is that they have that willingness, that the lack of self-concern. You know, the greatest force in human nature is self-preservation. Really. I mean, it really is. You're going to find food when you're hungry. You're going to sleep when you're tired. You're going to do what you can to survive. But putting aside your own self-preservation to go into a burning building that thousands of people are trapped in and risk your life doing it, I don't think there's any greater model of heroism than that.
Well, believe it or not, there are a bunch of really bad people that are actors too. So it's...
Speaking of that, shock,
which brings up, you know, of all the transitions that you've made, perhaps the most illogical one is your transition from working for the FBI and serving our country and then working in Hollywood with me. How did that happen?
Well, so when I left the FBI, took an early retirement, worked for the Department of Defense. I went back to Iraq. I had deployed to Iraq a couple times with the FBI, spent several months there. Loved the work. It was great. I worked with a lot of our elite special operations units over there in Iraq. So I did that. And then a new program was formed by the DOD to basically harness what I had done and bring more people in to do the same thing. And so I got assigned to a unit and went over to Iraq in 2007, spent almost all of 2007 working for DOD over there in uniform, assigned to a military unit. And it was phenomenal work. I loved it. But again, a little bit dangerous, mortar attacks, bombings, everything else that's happening in 2007 in Iraq. It's my third deployment there. My wife, again, is like when I was a cop and she's like, maybe you could get a job where you're not getting shot at every week. So this was, maybe you could get a job where you're not getting bombed every week. So I was preparing for a deployment, an 18-month deployment with the 101st Airborne Division to Afghanistan. And, we were going to go to Coast Province. And I spent 4 months at Fort Campbell, Kentucky with the 101st Airborne Division, preparing them for what we were going to be doing in Afghanistan, going after the, you know, basically Al Qaeda and the Taliban there. And then my brother calls me and says, hey, I'm having lunch with John Miller tomorrow. And John Miller, if you don't know, was a deputy director of the FBI at the time. So he was like the number three or four guy in the FBI. But he's a former NBC reporter who later went to CNN. I think he still works at CNN now. He had interviewed Osama bin Laden when he was a young reporter in like the, must have been the mid-90s or something. He'd go into a cave in Afghanistan and interviewed Osama bin Laden, kind of famous for that. But he interviewed John Gotti. He was a famous reporter, and the FBI brought him on to help with media and everything else within the FBI. So my brother says, hey, any chance you can come to DC and come to this meeting with me? So I said, okay. So I drive up to DC from Fort Campbell, Kentucky, go to have lunch with Deputy Director John Miller at FBI headquarters. And he says, look, you know, that show Criminal Minds is a really popular show and it positively portrays the FBI and we love it. Is there any way you guys can come up with some ideas of something else that the FBI you know, would like, and that would, you know, be positive of the FBI. And I said, well, you know, I had a pretty good squad when I was in the FBI. I worked narcotics first, but my terrorism squad, we went all over the world. We had some really odd characters that with unbelievable skills. Maybe we could try and sell a show about that. So he said, well, if you'll do it, the FBI will support you. And I said, well, wow. What does that support me? And they said, we'll give you access nobody else has ever had to the FBI. So that night, this was like a Thursday. That night, my brother and I flew to LA. And he said, hey, I know the producer of Criminal Minds. His name's Ed Bernero. He's the executive producer and the showrunner. And I didn't know what an executive producer or a showrunner was. So I was like, well, what does that mean? He said, well, he's a former cop. He's a great guy. Let's go talk to him and tell him about your idea. So next morning, Friday, we go meet with Ed Bernero. I tell Ed some stories about working these cases around the world, some of the people on my squad, some of the quirky, you know, one guy on my squad, Dan, grew up in Argentina. He was Jewish. His family was from Israel. He studied in Israel, spoke 9 languages fluently, and they were the 9 core languages that every other language on earth is based on.
Wow.
So he could decipher any language on earth if it came from one of these 9 core languages. He had a master's degree in archaeology. And we're like, why would this guy become an FBI agent? Well, we would go on a crime scene in Nairobi, Kenya. And he could tell you about the history. He knew all. He could communicate with anybody on the ground there, anybody. And then here we are in Yemen when the USS Cole had blown up. The same thing. He knows the history of the clans. As an archaeologist working crime scenes, he was unbelievable. So I'm telling these stories to Ed. Ed's like, stop right there. Hold on. Let me call my agent. So he calls his agent. His agent comes over. I'm telling the same stories to his agent. Stop right there. He calls CBS television. And by now it's 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. And we're like, you know, what good's it going to do to try and meet with anybody now? Like, you know, I worked in the federal government. It's known as Federal Fridays. At noon, everybody's on their way home from the federal government so they could beat traffic. So I'm sure nobody's in the office. They said, this is Hollywood. They work different hours. They don't come in till noon. So okay. So we went over to CBS. I have no idea who anybody is. There's like 5 or 6 people sitting across the table from us. Ed and his agent both turned to me and said, Tim, tell us some of those stories you told us. So I tell him about Dan. I tell him about working these crime scenes. I tell him about one couple on our squad, a husband and wife, 2 different areas of expertise, but they're the top evidence people in the world, bar none. And they were on an anniversary cruise one time, cruising in the Caribbean, and a helicopter flies up to their boat. And the loudspeaker comes on from the helicopter. Tom and Gene, you must get on the helicopter. We'll meet you on the forward deck. And it's an FBI helicopter, lands on the deck. They had to get in and they had to go work. I think they had to work a homicide in the jungles of Rwanda or something from that. So I'm like, here they are on it, trying to get away on the anniversary. And they end up in the jungles of Rwanda on their anniversary. And so I start telling these stories and this one guy goes, I want it. And then this lady over here goes, I want it. And Ed Bernero, before the meeting, says, if anybody says to you they want it, don't say another word except thank you, stand up, and walk out of the room. So they both said, I want it. I stood up. I said, thank you. I shook their hands, and I walked out of the room. And they were like, what the heck's he doing? And Ed's agent was like, get back in here, Tim. They want to hear the rest of the stories. And I said, oh, Ed told me to leave. So it turns out it was David Staff, the president of CBS Studios, and I can't remember Nina – whatever her name was, the president of CBS television. That's who we were pitching. I just thought these were just low level people that were, stuck on a Friday afternoon in the office. So we ended up selling a pilot to CBS. And so, wow. There was an organization that Gary Sinise founded where you and I met, Nick.
Yeah.
And, it was top an organization secret. That, yeah. So it was, I had above top secret clearances in the FBI, the highest national security clearances, but I never had to keep secrets like I did when I got to Hollywood.
That's right. Because
you're working. I working on every show I worked on. I worked on a half dozen CBS shows as a writer, as a consultant, as tech advisors, and a couple of Fox television shows. And it was like left wing lunacy run amok. They hate law enforcement. Here they are writing on a law enforcement show and acting on a law enforcement show, and all they do is disparage them at every turn. And the same with the military. I worked on the show The Unit, and it was about Delta Force. And here I was. I started there 2008. In 2007, I was in Iraq working with Delta Force, helping go after high-value targets. And now in 2008, I'm working on the set of a show about Delta Force, and they're disparaging them like they're the most evil group because Dick Cheney was the vice president at the time, and they figured Dick Cheney was more evil than Osama bin Laden.
Yeah.
It was just like mind-blowing. Hey, Tim,
I want to know more about, let's talk about a current event. I saw that you had were used as a subject matter expert on the Nancy Guthrie case. As an investigator, I worked in law enforcement for a lot of years in the Detective Bureau, and I'm blown away by this case just because it seemed that the smartest criminal in the world, which I think me and you will know it's the luckiest person in the world, has gotten away so far with this crime. No evidence has really been developed other than a picture of the subject. There's been, as far as we know, no credible testimony from anybody, from an eyewitness or turning in a credible lead. It's been over a year now. Is it a year since this, or how many months?
No,
is it?
It's several months. I don't remember when it was.
What do you think? Yeah. What do you think is going on? Because it was everywhere, and now you hardly don't even hear about it anymore. What are your thoughts on the case?
That's a strange case. From the beginning, my first impression was that it was a home invasion gone wrong, that they went in there, thought they would get something of value out of there, or she had money or whatever because she has a nice house and she's living alone. They're thinking she'll be an easy target, and then maybe they wanted to do an ATM robbery with her and get her out of the house, go take her to her ATM and clean out her bank account. Obviously, something went south. My brother, who worked very closely with Dr. Henry Lee, the forensic
pathologist
expert, Connecticut State Police. He had worked with Dr. Lee for many years on a lot of cases. My brother was a criminal profiler for the FBI. So he looked at it, and he was looking at the blood spatter on the porch, and he said most of that spatter is aspirational. So it came from her coughing. So she, it's not blood dripping, but it's spatter that came from her coughing up blood. So she either was bleeding in her mouth or bleeding internally, but she had blood and she was coughing it up. And that's why there's this spatter going out. And he thinks her face was very close to the concrete, within 18 inches of the concrete when she was coughing up blood. So chances are they're dragging her out or something like that. That's what it seems like. And I think things went south. She probably died during the process, had a heart attack, or she was physically attacked by them. And, you know, they ended up getting rid of her body somehow. So I think the reason we haven't seen suspects identified yet, there had to be DNA left behind. It's almost impossible for a crime like this to occur without there being DNA left behind. And so the key was there were several black gloves and other things that were found in the desert area within a mile of her house or so. And when they found the gloves, everybody kept talking about, well, are they going to identify the suspect from the gloves? And I said, the more important question is, are they going to identify her DNA on the gloves? Because you have to find her first to associate the glove with the crime scene. And so if they find her DNA on it, then you look on the inside. Now there's the vast possibility that the person isn't in any DNA database.
Right. That's what I was going to say. He's never been arrested. So, yeah. I mean,
so it's never been arrested.
Being a base, they wouldn't have it.
Yeah. So they wouldn't have it. And then you go to the next sources, which is going to 23andMe, Ancestry.com, and all those entities to do a forensic genealogical search. And that can take months. And so a forensic genealogical search is, I think it was the Golden State Killer was captured that way. So the Golden State Killer, my brother advised on that case, and that one where they don't have his DNA. So they search, they don't find him in any DNA database. And then they start looking ancillary to that, relatives, cousins. And they found a couple of third cousins. They found a couple of second cousins, and they were able to narrow down and pinpoint to the bloodline of the person. And that's how they found the Golden State Killer. And so in a situation like this, it's not something that can be done in days. DNA analysis, the FBI can do a lab report and have a result back in 12 hours on that person if their DNA is already collected. If they're not, then it takes weeks and weeks and weeks of going down all these DNA trees to follow all the different strains of DNA that are within whatever sample they might have. And then that will bring them to, hopefully, distant relatives who have gone through 23andMe and had their DNA analyzed. And then that can bring them to a pool of suspects, a potential bloodline like this family tree. And then you're going to look for, okay, well, who from this family tree is in this area or traveled to this area? So it's an exhaustive search, but I guarantee that's what the FBI is primarily working on now. And the fact that so little evidence was left behind, I mean, the way the guy was dressed with the holster for the wrong gun, weird, wearing it in the front, everything about it was 100% amateur. But, you know, you watch enough CSI New York, you're going to see Gary Sinise chasing after these dudes that do everything they can to cover their tracks. And
what about no video evidence, Tim? This whole thing, you got, if they came on foot or in a vehicle, every house is a Ring door cam. We've got cameras up everywhere. You know, I can't believe nothing caught this that we know of.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure. I know there was a search for a type of vehicle and a vehicle for a period of time, looking for a specific vehicle that had passed by some Ring door cameras on the day and on prior days. And they were wondering, is this the suspect casing the place a month prior, a week prior? And then on the day, this vehicle also goes by. And so there's plenty of that video evidence that can be gathered as far as, do they ever get a license plate? Do they ever see any damage to the vehicle or direction of travel that points them in a particular geographic area where the suspect is coming from? All of that's extremely valuable. But the problem is, with a public case of that level of notoriety, you're going to get a lot of white noise in with that. So you're looking, you know, we're looking for a 1998 Ford Taurus that's silver in color. Well, you're going to get a billion yeah. responses that are not relevant in any way, and you still have to filter through that. So all of that white noise, while volume is helpful in an investigation, it's also hurtful because those are man hours that are now being wasted running down leads that turn out to be nothing. You know, not to mention the number of mentally ill people that will want to be a part of an investigation like this and provide just preposterous evidence and write letters in and give all kinds of stuff. So that happens. I mean, I've worked countless major investigations, 9/11 being one, but the Atlanta Olympic bombing in 1996, I manned the phones on the hotline within a couple hours of the bombing. And we were getting thousands of calls that were absolutely, hey, I have a cousin that lives in Toledo, Ohio, and I think he has a beard. Okay, what does that have to, literally, you're taking calls like that. And you're like, okay, thank you for that. Anything that might relate to the bombing? No, but I heard the bomber might have a beard. Okay, thank you. Can I get your name and number in case we need any more information from you? Yes, here. And so I just wasted 5 minutes. So another call might have been coming at the same time that nobody could answer because I'm taking that call. So all of that adds up. And I'm not saying people shouldn't call in if they have something legitimate, but there are a lot of man hours that get wasted going down, not even dead ends, but just driving off a cliff because you're getting something that's totally useless. And again, that story was all over the news. So the notoriety that created is going to cause a huge deluge of information to come in to the FBI, to the ATF, to the Sheriff's Department, everything.
Wow. Yeah. If it's a one-man operation that did it, we may never know what happened.
Tim, I know that, you know, working in Hollywood, you were talking about how all the writers are writing about cops and they hate cops. And I know, you know, just from my experience as an actor, you know, most of the actors I work with are totally nuts and you can't talk to them about anything because they have this mindset. And I know it must be worse in the writer's room. And I wanted to ask you, where do you think that comes from? I get asked that all the time. Why are so many actors leftists? And where do you think that mindset comes from?
You know, it's culture is downstream of art and entertainment. So it affects our culture. And Hollywood for so many decades has been doing this. And I think our educational institutions are becoming more left wing and they're you know, teaching communism. And you got school kids waving Hamas flags, not realizing they're supporting a terrorist organization.
Gays for Palestine. And, you know, they would kill you.
Totally logical a group right there. But so I think for decades, educational and arts have been pushing an agenda that is totally anti-American. It really is in every way. It's anti-capitalism. It's just anti-Western way of living. And they push things as if they think there's someplace better somewhere. There isn't. There's a reason why everybody in the world wants to come here. You know, they'll go other places first, but this is the goal. This is, it's the dreamland. And we live in the greatest nation ever assembled anywhere in the world. We have so many phenomenal institutions. Are we perfect? No, we're human. No human is perfect. You know, I'm Catholic. Maybe Jesus's mother was, but other than that, we all aspire to be good, but we can't be perfect. And America's the same way. And so Hollywood has just disparaged over and over and over again. And as I mentioned, so I was working on the show, The Unit. My first meeting was with all 14 of the writers and producers. And we were in the showrunner's home. And they asked me, well, we want to do something with a big conspiracy here in season 4 of the show, The Unit. What, do you have any ideas? And so I started throwing out these conspiracy cases I worked and how when I was in Iraq, we captured a courier that was hand delivering communications to Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. And this courier was captured on the Iranian-Iraqi border. So he was going from Iraq into Iran to get to Afghanistan to communicate with al-Qaeda. So there's a big conspiracy. You have Iranians, which are Shia, which are running Shia militias, running Hamas and Hezbollah and all other entities around the world. And then you have al-Qaeda, which is a Sunni entity. And Iraq was run by Sunnis, but is now run by Shia. So I'm explaining all of these, the networking of all these disparate groups that should be enemies, but aren't. They're all working together against us. And I'm explaining this whole thing and how bin Laden is getting his funding and how bin Laden was funding the effort in Iraq. Bin Laden was sending warriors. And there was a guy named Muhammad Yunus Ahmed that was a former Iraqi Ba'ath Party leader under Saddam, who was sending money to Saddam in exchange for the fighters coming to us. So I'm explaining all this to these writers and how it's all true and all these interconnected pathways of intelligence and human assets being sent into war to blow up American soldiers, the assets coming from Iran to do the same thing. And then at the end, I give about a 2-hour talk on this whole big conspiracy. And they said, this is phenomenal. But how do we point it to the real bad guy? And I said, Osama? And they said, no, Dick Cheney. And yeah. I thought it was a joke. And like you, yeah. I laughed. Nobody else laughed. And I said, what do you mean? And they said, well, but all the money is coming from Halliburton and Dick Cheney that does everything al-Qaeda's. And I said, did you not listen to anything I said? I said, no, none of the money's coming from Halliburton. Well, and they were shocked. They were like, they thought I was going to literally lead to how Dick Cheney and George Bush were behind it all.
Oh, yeah. And I thought, that's all they have. That's all they have are their fantasies about how we're the bad guys.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, to answer your question and the direction the country's going, they affect it. And thankfully, we have guys like you and the content you create and the things you're doing and things like Proud American Studios. I mean, how much of a game changer is this? Because it's like Elon buying Twitter, turning it into X and making it free speech. So there's no guardrails now and some horrible content is on there. But the nice thing is we are not being shut down like we were before there. So that helps so much. But having a place where there's content and there's entertainment and there's informative dialogue that isn't stifled from one direction to the other. And so, you know, all of this, what's the future of the country? We can only hope that Proud American Studios podcasts like this grow and grow in influence and the audience grows and more people are exposed to reality and the truth. Look, you have a problem. There's somebody kicking in your door and there's a guy with a shotgun on the other side of your front door. You could think cops are horrible, but I guarantee you're still dialing 911 to ask for their help.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and Tim, the other thing is, I mean, this kind of show in Proud American Studios, The Hero Next Door, is highlighting stories like yours. I mean, you gave us a snapshot of your life. There's guys like you that are doing this every day all around the world. And what I hope that Nick and all of us hope that we can start exposing these stories. We can start telling people about real people like you that are doing great things every day that nobody knows about.
Well, I appreciate you guys doing what you're doing, and I'm proud to be on you know, here next door, and I don't deserve that title. I do live next door to some people, so there I've got that part of it. I think I
you got
I
half of it.
Yeah.
Well, Tim, thanks so much for being here. It's been great talking to you. I wish we had another hour. I didn't even get to talk to you about all the going to your house and what a fabulous place you have up there and meeting your wife. But hopefully, we'll do this again one of these days.
Sounds great.
Yep,
I look forward to it.
Well, everybody, be sure to check us out, Proud American Studios, on all social platforms, and proudamericanstudios.com. And if you know of anybody that you would like to see on the program, a hero next door, let us know. Get in touch with us. We'd love to have you on. And thanks for watching. Thanks, Darcy.
You're welcome. Be safe, everybody.